Nadia walked along at the back of the column with Maya and Sax and Art, listening to reports as they came in. She got the rovers to drive on the dead piste to avoid kicking dust into the air. She tried to ignore the fact that she was tired already. It was mostly lack of sleep rather than muscular exhaustion, but it was going to be a long night. And not only for her. Many people on Mars were entirely city dwellers now and unused to walking very far at a time. She herself seldom did, though she was often on her feet around construction sites and didn't have a desk job like many of these people. Luckily, they were following a piste and could even walk on its smooth surface if they cared to, between the suspension rails on the edges and the reaction rail running down the middle. Most preferred to stay on the concrete or gravel roads running alongside the piste, however. Unfortunately, walking out of Isidus Planitia in any direction but north meant walking uphill. Libya Station was about 700 meters higher than Burrows, not an inconsiderable height. But the grade was almost continuous over the 70 kilometers, and there were no steep sections anywhere along the way. "It will help keep us warm," Sax muttered when Nadia mentioned it. It got later and later until their shadows were cast far to the east as if they were giants. Behind them, the drowning city, lightless and empty, black-floored, disappeared over their horizon, mesa by mesa, until finally Double-Decker Butte and Moeris Mesa were submerged by the skysill. The dusky, burnt umbers of Isidus took on more and more color, and the sky darkened and darkened until the fat sun lay burning on the western horizon, and they walked slowly through a ruddy world, strung out like a ragtag army in retreat. Nadia checked Mangalavid from time to time and found the news from the rest of the planet mostly comforting. All the major cities but Sheffield had been secured by the independence movement. Sabishi's Mound Maze had provided refuge for the survivors of the fire, and though the fire wasn't yet put out everywhere, the maze meant they would be okay. Nadia talked to Nano and Etsu for a while as she walked. The little wrist image of Nano revealed his exhaustion, and she said something about how bad she felt. Sabishi burned, Burrows drowned, the two greatest cities on Mars destroyed. "No, no," Nano said. "We rebuild. Sabishi is in our mind." They were sending their few unburned trains to Libya Station, as were many other cities. The nearest were also sending planes and dirigibles. The dirigibles would be able to come to their aid during the night's march, which was useful. Especially important would be any water they could bring with them, as dehydration in the cold and hyper-arid night was going to be severe. Nadia's throat was already parched, and she happily took a cupful of warm water from a passing rover handing them out. She lifted her mask and drank swiftly, trying not to breathe as she did. "Last call!" the woman passing out the cups called cheerily. "We'll run out after the next 100 people." Another kind of call came in from South Fossa. They had heard from several mining camps around Elysium, whose occupants had declared themselves independent of both the Metanationals and the Free Mars movement, and were warning everyone to stay away. Some stations occupied by Reds were doing much the same. Nadia snorted. "Tell them fine," she said to the people in South Fossa. "Send them a copy of the Dorsa Brevia Declaration and tell them to study it for a while. If they'll agree to uphold the human rights section, I don't see why we should bother with them." The sun set as they walked. The long twilight slowly ran its course. While there was still a dark purple twilight suffusing the hazy air, a boulder car drove up from the east and stopped just ahead of Nadia's group, and figures got out and walked over to them wearing white masks and hoods. By silhouette alone, Nadia recognized all of a sudden the one in the lead. It was Anne, tall and spare, walking right up to her, picking her out of the rabble at the tail end of the column without hesitation, despite the lack of light. The way the first 100 knew each other. Nadia stopped, stared up at her old friend. Anne was blinking at the sudden cold. "We didn't do it. Anne said brusquely. The Arms Corps unit came out in armored cars, and there was a real fight. Cassay was afraid that if they retook the dike, they would try to retake everything everywhere. He was probably right. Is he okay? I don't know. A lot of people on the dike were killed, and a lot had to escape the flood by going up onto Syrtis. She stood there before them, grim, unapologetic. Nadia marveled that one could read so much from a silhouette, a black cutout against the stars. Set of the shoulders, perhaps. Tilt of the head. Come on, then, Nadia said. There was nothing else she could think to say at this point. Going out onto the dike in the first place, setting the explosive charges, but there was no point now. Let's keep walking. The light leaked away from the land, out of the air, out of the sky. They hiked under the stars through air as cold as Siberia. Nadia could have gone faster, but she wanted to stay at the back with the slowest group to do what she could to help. People were giving piggyback rides to some of the smaller children among them, but the fact was there weren't very many children at the end of the column. The smallest ones were already in rovers, and the older ones were up front with the faster walkers. There hadn't been that many children in burrows to begin with. Rover headlight beams cut through the dust they were throwing into the air, and seeing it, Nadia wondered if the CO2 filters would get clogged by fines. She mentioned this aloud, and Anne said, "If you hold the mask to your face and blow out hard, it helps. You can also hold your breath and take it off and blow compressed air through it if you have a compressor." Sax nodded. "You know these masks?" Nadia said to Anne. Anne nodded. "I've spent many hours using ones like them." "Okay, good." Nadia experimented with hers, holding the fabric right against her mouth and blowing out hard. Quickly, she felt short of breath. "We still should try walking on the piste and the roads and cutting down on the dust, and tell the rovers to go slow." They walked on. Over the next couple of hours, they fell into a kind of rhythm. No one passed them, no one fell back. It got colder and colder. Rover headlights partially illuminated the thousands of people ahead of them, all the way up the long, gradual slope to the high southern horizon, which was perhaps 12 or 15 kilometers ahead of them. It was hard to tell in the dark. The column ran all the way to the horizon, a bobbing, fencing collection of headlight beams, flashlight beams, the red glow of taillights. A strange sight. Occasionally there was a buzz overhead as dirigibles from South Fossa arrived, floating like gaudy UFOs with all their running lights on, their engines humming as they wafted down to drop off loads of food and water for the cars to retrieve and pick up groups from the back of the column. Then they hummed up into the air and away until they were no more than colorful constellations disappearing over the horizon to the east. During the time slip, a crowd of exuberant young natives tried to sing, but it was too cold and dry, and they didn't persist for long. Nadia liked the idea, and in her mind she sang some of her old favorites many times. "Hello, Central, give me Dr. Jazz," "Bucket's got a hole in it," "On the sunny side of the street," over and over and over. The longer the night went on, the better her mood became. It was beginning to seem like the plan was going to work. They were not passing hundreds of prostrate people, although the word from the cars was that a fair number of the young natives appeared to have blown it and gone out too fast and were now requiring assistance. Everyone had gone from 500 millibars to 340, which was the equivalent of going from 4,000 meters altitude on Earth to 6,500 meters, not an inconsiderable jump, even with the higher percentage of oxygen in the Martian air to mitigate the effects. Thus, people were coming down with altitude sickness. Altitude sickness tended to strike the young a bit more than the old anyway, and many of the natives had taken off very enthusiastically. So some were paying for it now, with headaches and nausea felling quite a few. But the cars reported success so far, taking in the ones on the edge of vomiting and escorting the rest. And the rear of the column was keeping a steady pace. So Nadia trudged on, sometimes hand in hand with Maya or Art, sometimes in her own world, her mind wandering in the biting cold, remembering odd shards of the past. She remembered some of the other dangerous cold walks she had taken over the surface of this world of hers, out in the great storm with John at Rabe Crater, searching for the transponder with Arcady, following Frank down into Noctis Labyrinthus on the night they escaped from the assault on Cairo. On that night, too, she had fallen into an odd, bleak cheerfulness, response to a freeing from responsibility, perhaps, to becoming no more than a foot soldier, following someone else's lead. 61 had been such a disaster. This revolution, too, could devolve into chaos. Indeed, it had. No one in control. But there were still voices coming in over her wrist from everywhere, and no one was going to strafe them from space. The most intransigent elements of the transitional authority had probably been killed outright in Cassay Vallis, an aspect of Art's integrated pest management that was no joke. And the rest of UNTA was being overwhelmed by sheer numbers. They were incapable, as anyone would be, of controlling a whole planet of dissidents, or too intimidated to try. So they had managed to do it differently this time, or else conditions on Earth had simply changed, and all the various phenomena of Martian history were only distorted reflections of those changes. Quite possible. A troubling thought when considering the future. But that was for later. They would face all that when they came to it. Now they only had to worry about getting to Libya Station. The sheer physicality of the problem, and of the solution to the problem, pleased her immensely. Finally, something she could get her hands on. Walk. Breathe the frigid air. Try to warm her lungs from the rest of her, from the heart. Something like Nergal's uncanny heat redistribution, if only she could. It began to seem like she could actually catch little bursts of sleep while still walking. She worried it was CO2 poisoning, but continued to blink out from time to time. Her throat was very sore. The tail end of the column was slowing down, and rovers were now driving back to it and picking up all the people who were exhausted and driving them up the slope to Libya Station, where they would drop them off and return for another load. A lot more people were beginning to suffer altitude sickness, and the Reds were telling victims over the wrist how to pull off their masks and vomit, and then get the masks back on before breathing again. A difficult, unpleasant operation at best, and many people were suffering CO2 poisoning as well as altitude sickness. Still, they were closing on their destination. The wrist images from Libya Station looked like the inside of a Tokyo subway station at rush hour, but trains were arriving and departing on a regular basis, so it looked like there was going to be room for the later arrivals. A rover rolled up beside them and asked them if they wanted a lift. Maya said, "Get out of here! What's the matter? Can't you see? Go help those people up there! Come on, stop wasting our time!" The driver took off quickly to avoid more castigation. Maya said hoarsely, "To hell with that! I'm 143 years old, and I'll be damned if I don't walk the whole way. Let's pick up the pace a little." They kept the same pace. They kept at the back of the column, watching the parade of lights bobbing in the haze ahead of them. Nadia's eyes had hurt for several hours, but now they were getting really painful, the numbness of the cold no longer a help, apparently. They were very, very dry and sandy in their sockets. It stung to blink. Goggles with the masks would have been a good idea. She stumbled over an unseen rock, and a memory shot into her from her youth. One time, she and some co-workers had had their truck break down in the southern Urals in winter. They had had to walk from the outskirts of the abandoned Chelyabinsk 65 to Chelyabinsk 40, over 50 frozen kilometers of devastated Stalinist industrial wasteland. Black abandoned factories, broken smokestacks, downed fences, gutted trucks, all in the snowy, frigid winter night under low clouds. Like something out of a dream it had been, even at the time. She told Maya and Art and Sax about it, her voice hoarse. Her throat hurt, but not as badly as her eyes. They had gotten so used to intercoms, it was funny to have to talk through the air separating them, but she wanted to talk. I don't know how I ever could have forgotten that night, but I haven't thought of it in the longest time. I'd forgotten it. It must have happened, what, 120 years ago? This is another one you'll remember, Maya said. They shared brief stories about the coldest they had ever been. The two Russian women could list 10 incidents colder than the very coldest experiences Sachs or Art could come up with. How about the hottest? Art said. I can win that one. One time I was in a log-cutting contest in the chainsaw division, and that just comes down to who has the most powerful saw, so I replaced my saw's engine with one off a Harley Davidson and cut the log in under 10 seconds. But motorcycle engines are air-cooled, you know, and did my hands get hot? They laughed. Doesn't count, Maya declared. It wasn't your whole body. Fewer stars were visible than before. At first Nadia put it down to the fines in the air or the trouble with her sanded eyes, but then she looked at her wrist pad and saw it was almost 5 a.m., dawn soon, and Libya Station was only a few kilometers away. It was 256 degrees Kelvin. They came in at sunrise. People were passing around cups of hot tea that smelled like ambrosia. The station was too crowded to enter, and there were several thousand people waiting outside. But the evacuation had been proceeding smoothly for several hours, organized and run by Vlad and Ursula and a whole crowd of Bogdanovists. Trains were still coming in on all three pistes from east, south, and west, and loading up and leaving soon thereafter. And dirigibles were floating in over the horizon. The population of boroughs was going to be split up immediately. Some taken to Elysium, some to Hellas, and farther south to Haranyagarba and Christianopolis. Others to the small towns on the way to Sheffield, including Underhill. So they waited their turn. In the dawn light, they could see that everyone's eyes were extremely bloodshot, which, along with the dust-caked masks still over their mouths, gave people a wild and bloody look. Clearly, goggles were in order for walks out. Finally, Zeke and Marina escorted the last group into the station. At this point, quite a few of the first 100 had found each other and clustered against one wall, drawn by the magnetism that always pulled them together in a crisis. Now, with the final group in, there were several of them. Maya and Michelle, Nadia and Sax and Anne, Vlad, Ursula, Marina, Spencer, Ivana, the coyote. Over by the pistes, Jackie and Nirga were directing people into trains, waving their arms like symphony conductors and steadying those whose legs were giving out at the last minute. The first 100 walked out to the platform together. Maya ignored Jackie as she walked past her onto a train. Nadia followed Maya on board, and then came the rest of them. They walked down the central aisle, past all the happy two-toned faces, brown with dust above, clean around the mouth. There were some dirty face masks on the floor, but most people were holding theirs clutched in their hands. Screens at the front of each car relayed film that a dirigible was showing of boroughs, which this morning was a sea of ice-coated water, the ice predominant, although the black polynyas were everywhere. Above this new sea stood the 9 maces of the city, now 9 cliff-walled islands, not very tall, their top gardens and remaining rows of windows truly strange-looking above the dirty, brash ice. Nadia and the rest of the first 100 followed Maya through the cars to the last one. Maya turned around and saw them all, filling the final little compartment of the train, and said, "What? Is this one going to Underhill?" "Odessa," Sax told her. She smiled. People were getting up and moving forward so that the old ones could sit together in the final compartment, and they didn't decline the courtesy. They thanked them and sat. Soon after that, the compartments ahead of them were full. The aisles began to fill. Vlad said something about the captain being the last to leave a sinking ship. Nadia found the remark depressing. She was truly weary now. She couldn't remember when she had last slept. She had liked Burroughs, and a huge number of construction hours had been poured into it. She remembered what Nanao had said about Sabishi. Burroughs, too, was in their minds. Perhaps when the shoreline of the new ocean stabilized, they could build another one somewhere else. As for now, Anne was sitting on the other side of the car, and Coyote was coming down the aisle to them, stopping to press his face to the window glass and give a thumbs up to Nergal and Jackie still outside. Those two got on board the train, several cars ahead of the last one. Michelle was laughing at something Maya had said, and Ursula, Marina, Vlad, Spencer, these members of Nadia's family were around her and safe, at least for the moment. And as the moment was all they ever had, she felt herself melting into her seat. She would be asleep in minutes. She could feel it in her dry, burning eyes. The train began to move. Sax was inspecting his wrist pad, and Nadia said to him drowsily, "What's happening on Earth?" "Sea level is still rising. It's gone up 4 meters. It looks like the Metanationals have stopped fighting for the time being. The World Court has brokered a ceasefire. Praxis has put all its resources into flood relief. Some of the other Metanats look like they might go the same way. The UN General Assembly has convened in Mexico City. India has agreed that it has a treaty with an independent Martian government." "That's a devil's bargain," Coyote said from across the compartment. "India and China, they're too big for us to handle. You wait and see." "So the fighting down there has ended?" Nadia said. "It's not clear if that's permanent or not," Sax said. Maya snorted. "No way it's permanent," Sax shrugged. "We need to set up a government," Maya said. "We have to set it up fast and present Earth with a united front. The more established we seem, the less likely they'll be to come hard to root us out." "They'll come," Coyote said from the window. "Not if we prove to them that they'll get everything from us they would have gotten on their own," Maya said, irritated at Coyote. "That will slow them down."
"They'll come anyway," Sax said.
"We will never be out of danger until Earth is calm, is stabilized."
"Earth will never be stabilized," Coyote said. Sax shrugged.
"It's we who have to stabilize it," Maya exclaimed, shaking a finger at Coyote. "For our own sakes."
"Aerial forming Earth," Michelle said with his ironic smile.
"Sure, why not?" Maya said. "If that's what it takes."
Michelle leaned over and gave Maya a kiss on her dusty cheek. Coyote was shaking his head.
"It's moving the world without a fulcrum," he said.
"The fulcrum is in our minds," Maya said, startling Nadia.
Marina also was watching her wrist, and now she said,
"Security still has Clark and the cable. Peter says they've left all of Sheffield but the socket. And someone has reported seeing Hiroko in Hiranyagarbha."
They went silent at this, thinking their own thoughts.
"I got into the UNTA records of that first takeover of Sabishi," Coyote said after a while, "and there was no mention at all of Hiroko or any of her group. I don't think they got them."
Maya said darkly,
"What's written down has nothing to do with what happened."
"In Sanskrit," Marina said, "Hiranyagarbha means the golden embryo." Nadia's heart squeezed. "Come out, Hiroko," she thought. "Come out, damn you, please, please, damn you, come out." The look on Michelle's face was painful to see. His whole family disappeared.
"We can't be sure we've got Mars together yet," Nadia said to distract him. She caught his eye. "We couldn't agree in Dorsa Brevia. Why should we now?"
"Because we are free," Michelle replied, rallying. "It's real now. We are free to try, and you only put your full effort into a thing when there is no going back.
The train slowed to cross the equatorial piste, and they rocked back and forth with it.
There are Reds blowing up all the pumping stations on Vastatas, Coyote said. I don't think you're going to get any easy consensus on the terraforming.
That's for sure, Anne said hoarsely. She cleared her throat.
We want the Saleta gone, too.
She glared at Sax, but he only shrugged.
Echo Poesis, he said. We already have a biosphere. It's all we need. A beautiful world.
Outside, the broken landscape flashed by in the cool morning light. The slopes of Torina were tinted khaki by the presence of millions of small patches of grass and moss and lichen tucked between the rocks. They looked out at it silently. Nadia felt stunned, trying to think about all of it, trying to keep it from all mixing together, blurring like the rust and khaki flow outside. She looked at the people around her, and some key inside her turned. Her eyes were still dry and raw, but she was no longer sleepy. The tautness in her stomach eased for the first time since the revolt had begun. She breathed freely. She looked at the faces of her friends, Anne still angry at her, Maya still angry at Coyote, all of them beat, dirty, as red-eyed as the little red people, their irises like round chips of semi-precious stone, vivid in their bloodshot settings. She heard herself say, Arkady would be pleased. The others looked surprised. She never talked about him, she realized.
Simon, too, Anne said. And Alex. And Sasha. And Tatiana.
And all our lost ones, Michelle said quickly before the length of the list grew too great.
But not Frank, Maya said. Frank would be thoroughly pissed off at something.
They laughed, and Coyote said,
And we have you to carry on the tradition, eh?
And they laughed some more as she shook an angry finger at him.
And John?
Michelle asked, pulling Maya's arm down, directing the question at her.
Maya freed her arm, kept shaking a finger at Coyote. John wouldn't be crying doom and gloom and kissing off Earth as if we could get by without it. John Boone would be ecstatic at this moment.
We should remember that, Michelle said quickly. We should think what he would do. Coyote grinned.
He would be running up and down this train getting high. Being high. It would be a party all the way to Odessa. Music and dance and everything.
They looked at each other.
Well, Michelle said.
Coyote gestured forward.
It doesn't sound as if they're actually needing our help.
Nevertheless, Michelle said. And they went forward up the train.
The End. You've been listening to Green Mars by Kim Stanley Robinson, narrated by Richard Ferrone.